You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Thursday, January 12th. My mama's birthday. I'm just trying to remind myself, so I'm sure to pick up the phone a little bit later. Love you, Mom. 74 years young. I won't tell. Oh, I just did. Sorry. lots to do in the program today. It's a Thursday, of course, so in the second hour, we'll have Father Alan Carter in. Father Alan, who is a priest here in the Diocese of Lexington, where we broadcast from. He's on every Thursday, most Thursdays anyway, for First Cup Theology. And you know, we talked a little bit last week about how the Christian faith is fundamentally about responding to a call. You read that opening chapter of John's Gospel and Jesus' encounter with his first disciples, in which he says, "Come and see." Or as he walks along the Sea of Galilee in the other Gospels and he encounters them and he says, "Follow me." So Christianity, by its very nature, it's about responding to a call. The initiative always starts with God. That's a pattern you see. And Father Allen's sharing about that last week. Of course, he's the head of the vocations office for the diocese here. Vocations, which has as it at its root the very word, etymologically speaking, same word as voice, vocal, vocation, call. And, of course, he does a lot of work in trying to cultivate an openness to a call in people's lives for how they live out their particular universal call to being made perfect in love, that call to communion with Christ and with others. And in particular, he focuses on those who are called to priesthood and religious life. We're going to talk to him, though, today on a more personal basis about his own call, both his call to faith in Christ, his call to the Catholic Church, which came later, and then his call to priesthood. How did that all go down? So be good to hear a little bit of his story. We may have talked about it before a good while back, but not bad to hit the refresh button on that. So look forward to having Father Allen on in the second hour. Also, we'll talk about Andy Griffith, Barney Fife, politics, and firefighting. Here recently with following all that's going on with the transition from the current POTUS to the coming POTUS, that's President-elect of the United States, if you want to know the acronym, and just watching human behavior on social media got me thinking about one of my favorite episodes of the Andy Griffith Show. I am an unabashed Andy Griffith Show fan. I'm sure I've seen every episode multiple times, still love to sit and watch it, and particularly that dynamic between Barney and Andy. Andy's more the straight man. Barney's, you meet people like this. I call them the spatula patrol. You sometimes got to peel them off the ceiling with a spatula. And it wasn't always that way in the show. The first, I'm not real fond of the first season, if you ever see it, because Andy tries to go all super country bumpkin. And you're kind of missing the straight man. And for some reason after that, Andy became, you know, the accent wasn't quite as bumpkin-ish, and he was a little bit more cool-headed, and Barney, of course, could go crazy. It was perfect dynamic, one of the great shows of all time. But I think there's some message in one of my favorite episodes. It has to do with selling miracle salve and all that. So you may know the episode I'm talking about. We'll get into that a little bit later as well. We'll also talk about that Donald Trump press conference yesterday. Interesting indeed. And other things related to the transition. We're now 8 days away from the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States. And we'll also talk a little bit about the limits of mere Christianity. Mere Christianity, a concept that, of course, is on the title of a C.S. Lewis book that was derived from a series of radio talks that he gave. And I've got that a little bit on my mind. I think I talked about it a bit yesterday, but yesterday afternoon I had the opportunity to go down to my alma mater when I was studying to be for Methodist ministry, seminary, Asbury Seminary, right down the road from where we broadcast from. I have fond affection for Asbury Seminary. Great memories of being there. Went there two different times, actually. And in many ways, as I tell people, the same things I love about the Catholic Church are the things that I love about Asbury Seminary, and vice versa. It's where I really developed a love for Scripture and a confidence in the cohesion of Scripture and the accessibility of truth, universal truth, and all the rest. And there's a vibrancy there on the campus. But I was invited in. A friend of mine, who I'd known from high school, is a philosophy professor out there and was teaching a class on basic Christian doctrine. He thought he would invite a Catholic in, particularly an alum who had become Catholic, to answer questions from their evangelical students about Catholicism on this basic Christian doctrine class. He said he was trying to expand their thinking into more of a mere orthodoxy or mere Christianity idea. In other words, that the Christian faith was bigger than their particular, you know, sect, or, you know, to not be quite so provincial and to have an appreciation for Catholicism. So I thought it was pretty cool. So I went down there yesterday and drug Father Frank Bronner along with me. I thought I really needed to shake things up and bring a guy in a cassock. One of the questions that was asked, by the way, during the Q&A time, one of the last ones, it was kind of off the cuff, but a guy had said to Father Frank, "How do you button all those buttons?" Because a cassock starts, you know, low and goes all the way up with buttons about an inch apart. Father Frank said, "You don't. You only unbutton about the top five, and then you pull it off." He said, "The problem with buttoning all of them is invariably," he said, "you're going to be in a hurry, and then all of a sudden you're going to realize, oh my goodness, I got to button all these buttons." And then he said, "The second invariably is you're going to get off on one button, and then you know how that goes when you only button four or five for your shirt." So that was pretty funny. But anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit too. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to be a part of the program anytime today. 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. We're not quite at the weekend. We're getting there, aren't we? Getting there for sure. Readings for today, of course, we seem to be all this week in the mass readings, the first reading being from the book of Hebrews, the letter to Hebrews, to who this day we really don't still officially know who the author of the book is. Maybe we'll get into that passage a little bit in the second hour. But the gospel reading, we've been in Hebrews for the first reading. We're in the Gospel of Mark here as we have begun ordinary time. And so during the early weeks of ordinary time, or really ordinary time all the way through, we kind of walk through the public life and ministry of Jesus. You know, you've got these sort of seasons in the life of our Lord. You've got, of course, his infancy and hidden life beginning with his conception, really, all the way through. The only other detail we have after his infancy or toddlerhood is the finding of Jesus in the temple. And then you've got, of course, this long hidden time in his life. I mean, you've got that one snippet at age 12, but basically between the ages of, let's say, 1 or 2 and 30, we have hardly anything. Somewhere in there, there's a lesson for us, about preparation for mission, for ministry, and for the importance, I think, of family life and those foundations. Our Lord born into a family. But anyway, so Mark's gospel, though, doesn't have an infancy narrative. Unlike Matthew and Luke, we first meet Jesus when he erupts on the scene. And as I said yesterday, I'm talking about this right now with my New Testament class this semester, teaching seniors. I'm really not that concerned about a ton of academic work for them. I want them to meet the Jesus of the Gospels and to encounter him in as fresh a way as possible. Not simply what they think they know about Jesus or the image they have from movies or films, typically a pale, British-accented Jesus who's very meek and mild and blessed are the poor in spirit. But to encounter, particularly in Mark's gospel, the Jesus who erupts onto the scene proclaiming a kingdom really with political overtones, and who begins to act. You know, even that opening phrase from Mark's gospel, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Well, Christ had political overtones, and that it meant literally the anointed one or the Messiah, the one who the Jews expected to come and, among other things, defeat their enemies. And then that phrase, Son of God, many scholars think Mark wrote his gospel to Christians in Rome during a time of great persecution. And of course, the Roman emperor always considered himself a son of God. And so right from the get-go, Mark's gospel is very subversive, just as Jesus' own ministry was. And Jesus comes acting. Not a lot of fluff in Mark's gospel. Well, not fluff. There's not fluff in any of the gospels, but there's not a lot of teaching narratives. It's Jesus acting. As I told my students, if you think about that book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, made into the movie Narnia, what's the phrase about the lion, Aslan, who's very much a Christ figure, when he first breaks into the scene in the witch's kingdom where it's always winter and never Christmas? Aslan is on the move. Aslan is on the move. We'll talk about this a little bit more in the second hour, Mark's gospel, because the reading today, a perfect other example of that. And of course, when he's on the move, he has opponents. We'll be back in a minute with more question of the day on the other side of the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to BBM Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Mania. We are, you know, officially past the 12 days of Christmas. You know, depending on who you talk to and everything, we're kind of still slightly somewhat, I know it's ordinary time, but we are in the afterglow of Christmas, Christmastide, from what I understand, all the way up to the Feast of the Presentation, February 2nd, otherwise known as Groundhog Day. But it occurred to me yesterday as I sat there doing some show prep work last night, sitting in my favorite recliner and staring at our pathetically dead Christmas tree, which is still up in the corner of the room. And I was having a little bit of writer's block for a question of the day. And I thought, well, we'll just throw this one out there. Is your Christmas tree still up? Now, to be honest with you, it means nothing to me if you have an artificial tree, because come on, if I had an artificial tree, I'd probably leave it up year-round. But if you have a live tree, especially one like we did, we usually get our tree maybe somewhere around the 10th, the 12th of December, somewhere in there. But this year we had kind of a unique circumstance, somebody home for the weekend. Thanksgiving weekend, wanted to make sure we put the tree up while they were home. So we've had our tree up since the end of November. Now, the good thing about having the tree there, well, just real quick, so the question of the day is your Christmas tree still up? And what's the latest you've ever had one up? 573-4BREAD-4, CB in the studio, ready to take your call. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or Twitter. How about you, CB? Tree still up? Wow, you're so good. Was it the first Christmas in your new place?
There wasn't a tree.
What? There was no tree? Wow. Man, Grinch. Anyway, So what do you think? Is your Christmas tree still up? What I was going to say is the good thing, you know, our Christmas tree is just, you know, just an arm's length from our fireplace. So the great thing is there's nothing better for kindling than dried out Christmas tree. So I can just reach up, snap off a twig or two or three, throw them in there, and really gets the fire going. So that's, you know, it's got a practical thing as well. So anyway, give us a shout. Ours is looking pitiful, though. I don't think we watered it as well as we should have. But I think the longest, I'm pretty sure we went past Valentine's Day one year. I don't think we've ever reached Ash Wednesday, but we flirted with it. So if you want to give us a call, I'd love to hear from you on that. I think we've gotten a couple of responses on social media, Facebook or Twitter, always an option. Let me see what some people said. But like I said, if it's an artificial tree, then they no biggie. You know, you can leave that up anytime you want. But a couple of responses here. Let's see. Dana says, mine is up. My only restriction is it must come down before Ash Wednesday. It's usually down by Valentine's Day. See, Dana, a person after my own heart. Megan says, mine is still up. I have never left it up past January. But when I was a kid, the year my younger sister was born, December 30th, we didn't put the tree away until Easter. Little smiley face. So, you know, that, obviously that's an artificial tree. The clue is you put the tree away. So, like I said, I don't find that embarrassing. Come on, Christmas in July, it's a fine tradition. But when you're, when all you have to do is brush up against your tree with a piece of flint and steel and the whole thing will explode, that's probably a good time to get rid of it, just saying. I noticed that ESPN.com had a piece yesterday basically saying, look, college football is now over. We had that instant classic Clemson-Alabama game the other night, and so now you can turn your attention to college hoops. So they have a guide here. Of course, I would make sure that Myron Metcalf, who wrote the piece for ESPN, is aware that for those of us in the state of Kentucky, we've moved on to basketball a little bit earlier. I mean, we had, you know, a nice end to our football season, bowl game notwithstanding, but typically in the state of Kentucky, our attention turns to basketball a lot earlier than this. But anyway, it was a good little summation article of what's happened in the season so far. Not the name of the piece. Not sure what's really important in college hoops. Here's your guide. And so he goes on to talk about UCLA and what a nice revival they're experiencing this year with Lonzo Ball and TJ Leaf, and how they are legitimate contenders for the national championship. And after seeing the way they handled my Kentucky Wildcats back in December, I have to say that's not misguided. Let's see. The of course, makes a point to talk about Grayson Allen and all the scandal with him, with kicking and tripping, but also some other confrontations. Clemson coach Brad Brownell and North Carolina's Roy Williams going toe-to-toe in a little bit of a shouting match. Oregon forward Dylan Brooks kicking a Washington State player in the nether regions, and coaches from Missouri and Georgia fighting midway through a game. He also says Baylor is number one for now. He obviously wrote this before Huggy Bear took him down hard the other night. Jim Boeheim, who's kind of getting crusty and curmudgeon-y even more than usual in his old age, and basically saying he doesn't care about his 10-6 record, that if we get to the Final Four, we can lose 20 games, it doesn't matter. And the Big Ten's big mess. And, of course, they do mention, thankfully, at the end, I think one of the great stories in college basketball, the backcourt, the freshman backcourt, University of Kentucky, Malik Monk and De'Aaron Fox. In fact, DeMarcus Cousins told ESPN's Jeff Goodman that Kentucky freshman guards Malik Monk and De'Aaron Fox remind him of John Wall and Eric Bledsoe. Wow. And Metcalf goes on to say that with Monk and Fox, it just by their very nature gives Kentucky a chance to compete for the national championship. And then there was a nice little piece here about, by the way, speaking of DeMarcus Cousins, one of the funniest things that I saw recently was a meme going around after the whole Grayson Allen kicking incident of Ricky Bobby from Talladega Nights, the movie, you know, Will Ferrell, praying, said, "Dear sweet baby Jesus, I please ask that Grayson Allen be drafted and trip DeMarcus Cousins." That'll cure him. And then there's a nice piece out here about Leonard Hamilton, Leonard Hamilton, my goodness, he's got to be pushing, I would think, 70 years old. I need to look that up, because I know he was an assistant coach on Kentucky's national championship team back in 1978, way before CB was breathing oxygen. Anyway, and he's still around and having really perhaps a career year. So happy for him, and good to see. And then there's the thing in here about Jeff Capel's audition. not off to a good start because of the aforementioned Leonard Hamilton and his Florida State Seminoles. So college basketball, it's going to be fun. I think it's pretty wide open this year. I think right now, still, I think you got to consider Villanova the team to beat until someone knocks them off. But interesting sports perspective here, 538 with their 2016 NFL predictions in terms of who has the best chance to win the Super Bowl based on their ELO rating. This surprised me a little bit because they've got New England with a 35% chance of winning the Super Bowl. Second is Kansas City with a 15%. So New England more than double the percentage chance of anybody else. Kansas City at 15%, Atlanta at 13%, and Dallas coming in fourth at 12%. Sorry, Cowboys fans. Of course, you got to win it on the field. Let's give our What Were You Thinking? What am I thinking? Let's get to What Were You Thinking? Award spanning the globe. Finding excellent examples of human imbecility. We all have them from our own lives. This from the Buffalo News, where they get that lake effect and pretty good wind. It says, last night's winds and gusts were pretty strong and pretty noisy. Apparently, the howling winds got so loud, somebody in Niagara Falls decided they should call the cops. A police dispatcher notified officers on patrol someone was asking for their help, according to the archived audio of the transmission. All cars be advised, someone called to see if the police could stop the wind from blowing so they could sleep. If any of you guys could do that, could you let me know? Oh, man, they've got the audio on here. I'll have to see if I can pull this up later. I have a feeling there was some imbibing going on. Could you stop the wind? It's really getting on my nerves. All right, here's our second one. Woman tries to smuggle boyfriend out of prison in a suitcase. A Venezuelan man was caught trying to get her detained boyfriend out of Puente Ayala prison by packing him in a large suitcase. You got to see this photo. I'll post this on the show's Facebook page, because he does raise the question, how little is this guy and how big is the suitcase? He actually fits in there quite nicely. Kind of looks like my cat curled up in a dresser drawer. 25-year-old Antoinetta Soda arrived at the prison to visit her boyfriend, who's serving a sentence of 9 years and 8 months for car theft. She brought their 6-year-old daughter in a large pink suitcase. So anyway, go on to plan B, I guess. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Here on this Thursday, the 12th. A pleasure to be with you. 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to call in, you can call or text, actually, that number, 573-4-BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. My question of the day, is your Christmas tree still up? I mean, the confessional booth is open. I can't grant you absolution, but we can commiserate together. Is your Christmas tree still up? And what's the latest it's ever been up? 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We have given out two nominations for our What Were You Thinking Award. And so now let's give our winner. This is from the news out of Toronto. Pretty rough winters up there. Driver trying to impress passenger gets Jeep stuck in Lake Ontario. A driver, quote, trying to impress, unquote, a passenger sank his Jeep into Lake Ontario after his off-roading adventure took a wrong turn Tuesday morning. It took officers more than 2 hours to pull the stranded vehicle from 2 feet of water at Cherry Beach after the driver drove onto the ice, not realizing he had left the snow-covered road. So, Constable Allison Douglas Cook told the news, someone decided to go off-road because they were driving a Jeep. The driver was trying to impress a passenger, probably a girl. I mean, trying to impress a girl, not to be a stereotyper or anything like that. As the Toronto police tweeted out, Jeep driver wandered off-road, didn't realize under snow was lake. Will face tow bill. It's pretty bad when the police are mocking you on Twitter. You know what I mean? But going off-road kind of reminds me of one of my own What Were You Thinking moments. We've all got them. I remember years ago, gosh, this is probably 22, 23 years ago, had a friend who had a bike shop. I was living in Myrtle Beach at the time, so I decided I wanted a mountain bike. Kind of needed to get in some better shape. Story of my life. So I bought this mountain bike, this Diamondback. It was nice. I mean, it was a low-end Diamondback, but it was a nice mountain bike. And I decided to ride it home from the bike shop, which was, you know, about 3 miles from my house. And all was going well. Had my helmet on and everything, and turned into my little patio home subdivision that where we were living at the time. And when I pulled into the subdivision, I thought to myself, you know, I need to take this thing off-road. It's a mountain bike. And so in our little patio home subdivision was a little, it was a kind of a little dip off the road where it kind of went down into a little, maybe 18, 24 inch wide drainage ditch, culvert sort of thing, and then back up again. And I thought, here's where I need to go. Just down this little hill and across this little drainage ditch. And so I go down the little, you know, sloped hill, not steep. Got to start small, you know. But I didn't realize, I guess, that when you come to the bottom and you hit that drainage ditch, you gotta pull up on the front handlebars. I just rode my bike straight into that concrete culvert. Of course, laws of physics, the bike comes to a stop, me not so much. So I go hurtling head first, arms behind me over the handlebars, and I plant my forehead and face right into the ground. Now, two thoughts immediately. One, am I paralyzed? Which I quickly realized I was not. Thought number two, of course, did anyone see? And fortunately, at least not that I know of, did anybody see, but it was kind of hard to hide because I had a huge skinned place on my forehead that I had to explain for weeks to come, particularly to my friend who sold me the bike. So always remember that. You've got that mountain bike. Pull up on it when you're coming to the bottom of a hill like that. Anyway, always open to yours if you've got your own stupid tax story to tell, because we've all paid it. 573-4-BREAD-4. Speaking of paying, I've got to remember later today to pay my speeding ticket that I got
driving to North Carolina back in December. $145 worth of wasted money. 573-4BREAD-4. Or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Yes, I've got a problem with speed. I've got a lead foot. Let's put it that way. I did not happen to watch, but let's see, I think we got a new comment on the Christmas tree question. Melissa says, ours is down. Well, good for you. A live tree forces me to take it down to avoid a fire hazard. My nativity set and mantle Christmas decorations are still up. I will put them away before or at least by Lent. How does a live tree force you to take it down? I've got proof positive that's not the case. Oh, I guess you care about your family. Okay. Anyway, I did not get a chance to see the Donald Trump presser yesterday, much anticipated. It was been kind of an interesting compare-contrast week, because the day before yesterday, you had the outgoing president, the lame duck President Obama, giving his farewell address, chose to do that in Chicago. The only reason I knew about it was because my social media was filled up with, you know, I'd say it was about 75%, 25% toward mocking the president, celebrating his exit with some pretty harsh things to say. About 25% say they appreciated it. So that's the only reason I even knew about his farewell speech, which he gave there in his adopted hometown of Chicago. And then yesterday, of course, the much-anticipated Donald Trump press conference, in which he evidently let the press kind of have it, and talked about some of the fake news, the whole BuzzFeed decision to release some unmerited, unsubstantiated reports on him that were, to put it mildly, extremely embarrassing, but now appears the whole thing was not true. Of course, it is a little bit disingenuous, I will say, of the president-elect to complain about fake news when he spent much of his campaign making unsubstantiated charges against Ted Cruz's father and President Obama's birth certificate. You know, what's good for the goose and all that. I read the transcript of his press conference yesterday. And, you know, the whole idea of his campaign, is a tremendous success story. I mean, he's elected president of the United States. What are you going to say? I mean, when everybody, including me, discounted him and the guy won. So what are you going to say? But anyway, his whole premise of his campaign was make America great again. So I decided I'd do a little word search on his remarks at the press conference. The word great or some version of it appears 31 times in his speech. I'll give you an example. He says, so I just want to compliment many of the people in the room. I have great respect for the news and have great respect for freedom of the press and all of that. I like that. And all of that. We've had some great news, talking about the auto industry. He goes on, there's a great spirit going on right now. We're going to create jobs. I said that I will be the greatest jobs producer that God ever created. And I mean that. The other words I want to look up were tremendous. He thinks that he said the word tremendous 5 times. How about fantastic? 6 times. So anyway, if you ever doubt how great a Trump presidency is going to be, just ask him. Now, the other news I noticed was Rex Tillerson, I guess, catching some flack from Marco Rubio in his confirmation hearings, the former ExxonMobil CEO who is slated to be Donald Trump's Secretary of State. And the piece here, this on CNN Politics, talks about how I guess Marco Rubio was really going after Rex Tillerson on the whole issue of how much the United States will hold other countries accountable in our relations with them in terms of How will we, in other words, how will we balance America's national security interests with our advocacy for human rights? And Marco Rubio trying to get Tillerson to categorically condemn human rights violations in Russia and the Philippines in particular. Tillerson was a little guarded with his comments, which Rubio found unacceptable. Wanted him to go harder after Putin, after Duterte in the Philippines and so forth. And let's see. Let me find the, you know, Tillerson's response was in terms of, because one of the things Rubio asked him about was whether he considered Russia's air attacks on civilian areas of the formerly held rebel city of Aleppo, whether that amounted to violations of the rules of war and war crimes. Tillerson said, those are very, very serious charges to make, and I would want to have much more information before reaching a conclusion. Rubio also asked him, Mr. Tillerson, do you believe that Vladimir Putin and his cronies are responsible for ordering the murders of callous dissidents, journalists, and political opponents? Now, I'm going to talk about this when we come out on the other side of the break, because I'm probably actually going to take up for Rex Tillerson here a little bit on this issue. But we'll get to it in just a minute. If you've got a question or a comment, 573-4BREAD-4. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on The Mike Allen Show. Next hour, we'll be talking to Father Alan Carter. He'll tell us a little bit about his call to the priesthood and how that all came about. Speaking of priests, as I said, I had the opportunity yesterday to spend some time with Father Frank Brauner, my good friend. Thank the world of Father Frank, and had a chance to go to my alma mater, Asbury Theological Seminary Evangelical School, and talk a little bit about the Catholic faith to a bunch of evangelical Protestants. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in the second hour. But one of the things Father Frank and I talked a little bit about was the novel Silence, which I've probably bored all y'all to tears talking about incessantly for the last 2 weeks, as I'm hoping the movie is going to come out here locally soon, the Shishaku Endo novel, the Japanese Catholic. It was amazing to me because Father Frank had read the book a little bit before me, but like me, it had the same effect. It just haunted him, and this whole issue of these priests and the choice that they faced with whether to stamp their foot on the image of Christ and stop the suffering of Christian peasants who are being tortured. It's just a whew. I hear the movie itself is haunting as well, but one of the things I'll talk about next hour is Andrew Garfield, who has a lead role in the film, the Scorsese film that's coming out, plays Father Rodriguez, really the central focused figure of the book. Garfield had his own experience with Jesus in playing a Jesuit and the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola, so we'll talk about that. Anyway, back to this story about Rex Tillerson. And, you know, as you know, I've not withheld my criticism of Mr. Trump and of some of not only things that he said publicly, but also choices. But and certainly the appointment of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to Secretary of State raised a lot of eyebrows. But this is a guy that does have a lot of experience in navigating relationships with foreign leaders as part of an international corporation. But Marco Rubio, grilling him yesterday during the confirmation hearings, and afterwards Rubio, unsatisfied, saying he's not sure if he'll support Mr. Tillerson because of this whole question of how do we balance U.S. interests with the larger issue of human rights. And Tillerson hesitant to categorically condemn the actions of Duterte in the Philippines or Putin in Russia. Tillerson said he would rely on the facts that would be available to him as Secretary of State before weighing in. According to this story, caused Rubio to pounce, noting that Duterte's claims of responsibility in the Philippines for the extrajudicial killings were reported in major newspapers. Tillerson argued that it was important that the U.S. retain the Philippines as an ally in a region marked by rising tensions with China, then allowed under intense pressure from Rubio that Duterte's actions did not appear appropriate. I mean, isn't this the challenge of foreign policy always in the United States? This is one thing I think that tends to be common among all administrations, is this very delicate diplomatic challenge of understanding that there are different kinds of almost a, what's the term, real politic approach to these things. Tillerson said this: "There seems to be some misunderstanding that somehow I see the world through a different lens. I share all the same values that you share and want the same thing for people the world over in terms of freedoms, but I'm also clear-eyed and realistic about dealing in cultures. These are centuries-long cultures, cultural differences." So here you have Tillerson, who appears to be sort of the voice of patience and reason, whereas Rubio is a little bit hawkish. And I understand it is certainly a difficult balance to face. But you did have former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who served under both Bush and Obama, who defended Tillerson and said he was properly cautious and that he had less freedom to talk about human rights than Rubio. If a Secretary of State makes a pronouncement about a country or an individual, then there are legal implications in terms of actions the United States has to take. I think that's an excellent point. But here's the, you know, I wish Rex Tillerson would teach some of his restraint to his boss. I mean, is President-elect Trump and soon to be President Donald Trump going to have the wherewithal to keep himself from tweeting things about foreign leaders that could have diplomatic repercussions? I don't know. I don't know whether the guy's got that much self-control. I guess we'll find out soon enough. It's a little scary. Let's move on to looking at history. What are some other things that have happened on this day throughout the ages, January 12th, besides the birth of my mother in beautiful Paintsville, Kentucky, back in 1943. Anyway, 1913, after using other pseudonyms over the years, Joseph Zugashvili, that's my best attempt, signed himself as Stalin, Man of Steel, in a letter to the paper, The Social Democrat, one of the great tyrants of the 20th century. 1951, Rush Limbaugh born. So happy birthday to Mr. Limbaugh, 66 years old today. You know, I will say this. I can only listen to so much of Rush. He is entertaining, and he is, let's face it, he's an entertainer. But here's, as somebody who talks on the radio every day, I have profound respect simply for the fact that he has been now for what? Pushing on, I'm sure, 30 years, talking 3 hours a day. It's pretty amazing. Anyway, Howard Stern, speaking to radio people, his birthday today, 63 years old today. Not a big fan, as you might imagine. Led Zeppelin's self-titled first album released on this day in 1969 and in 1969, making good on his guarantee on this day. Joe Willie Namath, Broadway Joe, led the Jets to an upset win over the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III, where they led to the merger of AFL-NFL. All in the Family premiered on this day in CBS, on CBS, 1971. In 2010, there was a catastrophic earthquake that struck Haiti. I can't believe it's been 7 years ago now.
killing over 200,000 people, destroying much of the capital of Port-au-Prince. And on this day, 11 years ago, Turkey released Mehmet Ali Agca from jail after he served 25 years for shooting Pope John Paul II. I believe he was there. Was he there at John Paul's canonization? I'm thinking he may have been. You know, now that's an interesting story, right? Because if you recall that, if you were around then, back in 1981, I wasn't even Catholic, and I remember the story. John Paul II went to visit Agca in prison, in jail, after he recovered from the gunshot wounds, which were very grave, and forgave him. But you'll notice, even in forgiving him, it did not end his incarceration. And I think that's an important thing to make, because I want to sort of transition from talking about that to a thing we got into a little bit yesterday, the trial and the sentencing of Dylann Roof, the young man who killed 9 parishioners at Emmanuel African American Episcopal Church there in Charleston, South Carolina. It's one of the worst stories that that I can ever imagine. You know, these Bible study attendees, they invite him in, they welcome him in a spirit of Christian hospitality. For this prayer and Bible study, they include him in their conversation, in their circle. And then at the end, while they're saying their closing prayers, he pulls a gun out and begins to shoot them in a racist rampage. Well, yesterday, family members of the 9 slain parishioners confronted Roof for the last time Wednesday in court. The 22-year-old, this according to ABC News, the 22-year-old avowed white supremacist refused to meet their gaze and simply stared ahead, his head tilted down slightly as it had been for much of the trial. "Dylann," Janet Scott said quietly. She started speaking. "Dylann, Dylann," she said, her voice rising. Toward the end, she said, "I wish you would look at me, boy." So all of them having something to say. Roof also had an opportunity to speak, but declined to say anything. He's the first person ordered executed for a federal hate crime. Some of the relatives looked directly at Roof. Others chose to look at the jurors, who did not have to be in court Wednesday, but told the judge they wanted to attend. Now, one of the things that they said was that they forgive him. Some of them said this, or at the very least, their forgiveness was a work in process. One victim's family member said that she cannot, she was actually there that night. Felicia Sanders said she can't even shut her eyes to pray. But one of the things that, you know, that's important to recognize is that even though they, forgiveness of the guilt of his crime does not remove his responsibility for punishment. And in this case, it looks like it's going to be the death penalty. But regardless, whether it's incarceration in a supermax prison or whatever, it's a good, we'll talk about this more in the second hour. Forgiveness does not mean the removal of consequences. And so we pray for Dylann Roof. Of course, we pray for repose of the soul of all the victims and comfort for their families. We'll be back with a new hour. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.